We'll bring the meeting to order. The Early Childhood Learning Finance Committee. We'll approve the minutes when we have a quorum here. We're doing a couple things today. We're having Chad Dunkley is here to give us a preview of what the tour is going to be like. I know most of you are going at our next meeting on Tuesday. We're going to have a presentation by our fiscal analyst, so we can start to get into some of the numbers. I know people were interested in doing that. We are going to have a presentation of the governor's budget by the Department of Education. Commissioner Segrin will be talking, as well as Karen Carlson. And we're going to have a presentation of the governor's budget by the Department of Human Services. We'll have Chuck Johnson and Sheree Kotelnik and Deb Swenson-Platt. It sounds like a lot. It is a lot, but it's actually, some of the proposals won't take as long as maybe some of your other committees have been taking. They're shorter, more concise proposals. On details, I know the whole group's not here. We could maybe wait a little bit, but we are going to carpool for Tuesday. We're hoping that people could meet at 350 on the east side of the state office building. And Sarah's going to be sending this out, right? And we have enough drivers, right? So if you can come to that side of the building, we'll be waiting out in the front at 350. We're going to go over to New Horizons. And Chad, can you come tell us a little bit about the tour? And we're going to see MFIP and Basic Sliding Fee in action, come back, and then there's an optional social afterwards at My Village. So it should be a very interesting tour. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Dunkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chad Dunkley. I am the Chief Operating Officer of New Horizon Academy. I'm also the current president of the Minnesota Child Care Association. And Representative Slauk explained, I'm very excited to have many of you come visit one of our programs. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about it and why I think this is a really exciting opportunity for us, but hopefully an opportunity for you, too. To see a program at work. I know this committee is very much focused, at least in the coming years, on at-risk children. And so when I was asked which facility of ours the committee may benefit most to come see, we chose my facility where I care for the highest percentage of families using child care assistance that you guys obviously make lots of decisions on. In this particular facility, there are almost 100 children. And of that, 90% of those children, or over 90 of those children, are using child care assistance. The facility is about 20 years old, and you'll be really impressed with what we do inside. It's not flashy, but it's a wonderful program. It's accredited by the National Association for the Education of Young Children. You may hear about a study about why that's really good for at-risk children. It is a 501c3, a nonprofit program, which many child care centers are, operated by New Horizon Academy. We're doing some exciting things. New Horizon Academy, we have the benefit of being based here in Minnesota for 35 years, so we're real familiar with what happens. We were the first program to fully incorporate the Minnesota Early Learning Standards into our program. And most of the tour, though we want to have some time for discussion, we're going to actually ask parents to be available, a couple of parents, so you could ask some questions if you want to, and they could share their story. But we really wanted to show you in a practical way how good programs are incorporating these standards in their daily practices, so we can show you in a classroom what we're doing. I know you're talking a lot about child assessment this year, and we have just created a brand new child assessment tool that's actually based on the Minnesota Early Learning Standards, and we're using that tool to guide our programming, but we're also using that to guide individual child assessment and be able to report back to parents and even suggest ideas of things they can do at home that goes along with all the learning that's happening in our program. But it's a wonderful program, but another part of it that I think is exciting is we are doing something that I don't know that's happening anywhere else nationally that I, from early childhood, am very excited about. We are working in a partnership with St. Paul Public Schools at that program, and they are sending teachers from the public school system into my program to mentor my teachers once a week to make sure that everything we're doing with the kids is getting them ready for St. Paul Public Schools. And it's been a phenomenal project. I'm so excited because one of the failings in our field, other than you may hear from me once in a while about money, but it's not the only failing, is the lack of coordination between early childhood and K-12. And it's so vitally important that we communicate effectively. And this has been a really great opportunity for us each to learn from each other. And I think they would tell you the same thing. And I believe a part of the governor's budget includes a significant increase to do this in a more broad way, and that we can show you exactly what we're doing, how it's helped us, and show you what the kids do every day. From infants, we care for infants as young as 6 weeks old, and we go up to school-age children that come before and after to 12 years old. So we're very excited. I hope everyone can come. I know Representative Slack asked that if for some reason you can't, she has my contact information, and I'd be happy to provide a separate tour for any of you should you need it to reschedule.
Thank you. Let's see if anybody has any questions. My objective, I'm trying to work from an objective point for each meeting, and for this tour is to see MFIP and basic sliding fee in action. The other thing is to have a good learning experience for you. I will tell you the last time when the Early Childhood Caucus visited the Child Care Center, we had members wandering off into other child care rooms. So what we talked to Chad about is we'll be in two small groups and we'll kind of try to stick together, and then we'll switch and do it that way because it would work much better. I don't know if they wandered, you know, we're just legislators, we're just doing our best, but I know you're going to have a great tour for us, right?
Yes, can I mention Representative Slaughter, a couple other things? Yeah, we were going to split up, but I'm going to have a few extra people available, so with each tour we'll have two people that fully understand the program, so we'll be able to share any questions you have. It'll be very relaxed. We also have, again, let the parents know, and if for some reason you'd like pictures taken, too, with some of the children or in the program, that they're all going to have releases available, too. But hopefully we can make sure to be more available and more relaxed. You can ask a lot of questions on our way. But most of it will be about program, but again, we'll have time for question and answer afterwards, more specifically when you see, as well as a few families available.
Representative Ward, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Duncan, can you tell me what areas that you mentioned that the St. Paul teachers are coming over to mentor your teachers as well?
Representative, yes, we are working on, and let me tell you the name of the project. I actually have, I thought I brought it up here. It is it's a kindergarten readiness program for the St. Paul Public Schools. They have a McKnight grant to actually provide this service to come out and do outreach in the community.
So is it all kindergarten teachers?
This is actually licensed early childhood teachers that work with the school readiness programs in the St. Paul Public Schools.
Thank you. Representative Murphy?
Yes, my question.
Okay, good. Good. Well, thank you. We will look forward to the tour on Tuesday. And thank you for coming in and taking the time to give us a preview. And we'll look forward to seeing you then. So, good. Thanks. Next, we will have Emily Adrians. Emily is right there, who will be giving us an overview of the fiscal part of our committee. Welcome to the committee. You know, I'm going to have us approve the minutes real quick here. I'm sure, let's see, Representative Ward, you've read the minutes?
I have.
Good, thank you. Representative Ward, moves the approval of the minutes for January 23rd. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. The motion prevails, and the minutes for the date are approved. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Adrians. If you could introduce yourself for the tape and give
Thank
us the overview.
You, Madam Chair and members, my name is Emily Adrians, and I'm the fiscal analyst for the committee. I've been losing my voice a little bit, so I'm hoping it'll just hold out for this. I'll be brief. I know we have a lot to get through today. We haven't spoken very much about the numbers for the committee in terms of the appropriations, so we thought, the Madam Chair thought this would be a good opportunity to do just a really quick overview of what this committee has control over in terms of the appropriations and everything. You should all have a packet that has this front page with you. It's about 8 pages long. And the first page, or it's actually page 2, what this is, I just wanted to give you a general sense of you know, some perspective for what, you know, how much there is in total of the general fund. And all this is going to be for the biennium for fiscal years 2008 and 9. And you'll see that early childhood learning makes up about 1.3% of the general fund appropriation. And the numbers to back that up are on the next page. And so for each year, it's about $210 million. These numbers are in thousands that I have in here. And these are all based on the November forecast. So once, you know, you'll hear the numbers with the governor's budget, and then once the February forecast comes out at the end of the month, at the end of February, these might change slightly at that point too. So this is just the baseline that we're starting from right now. And then if you look at the next page, and I also quickly wanted to mention some of the accounts that we have in this committee. It's from the two different agencies. It's the Department of Education and the Department of Human Services. And from education, we have the early childhood and family support program, and that's where I start in the school readiness programs are. And then we also have community education and prevention and the self-sufficiency and lifelong learning. And then for the Department of Human Services, that's where the MFIP child care and basic sliding through child care and the child care development grants are as well. So if you see this pie, you see that the child care grants, which are from DHS, make up a little bit more than half of the $420 million for the whole biennium that are in this committee. And those numbers are on the following page as well, where it's broken out a little bit more. And also to give you a sense of just some more perspective, since this is just the general fund appropriations, in terms of if we were to add in federal funding and other additional money that the agencies have, the total spending is $420 million from general fund, and the total is closer to like just under $650 million right now. And then if you'll go to the next page, I wanted to point out, this is just for the Department of Education accounts that are in the committee, and what I'm trying to show here is that the estimated revenue just for fiscal year 2008 is about $165 million, and of that $165 million, a little over half comes from the general fund appropriations. And so the rest of it's from levies. There's also some from fee revenues, and I didn't have that exact number here. If anybody's interested, I think I can get that. But I think what's important to consider is if there are two formulas that kind of go along with any changes that you might make on the education side, and the Department of Education people might speak more eloquently to this, but those are the early childhood formula and then the community education formula. So changes made in particular to the community education formula, I think, could affect the levy amounts. So, and we will certainly get more into the formulas in the future. I just want you to have that kind of in the back of your head for future reference. And then the next page is these are the participation rates for the Department of Human Services child care programs. And so I'm just showing the comparison between the MFIP and the BSF, the basic sliding fee participation rates. And what it shows is the average number of families per month who participate in each of these programs. And one thing that I thought was interesting to point out was in 2007, from 2007 to 2011, those are estimated participation rates. And there was a little bit of a jump, you'll notice there, in the basic sliding fee participation. And what I found is that there were some additional funds that were appropriated for 2007, and so that increased the number of families that they could support. And if you have more questions on this, I think I'll refer you to the Assistant Commissioner Chuck Johnson, who will speak a little bit more on the DHS for the governor's budget for them. And then the last page, this is a spreadsheet that I put together, and this is what I will I'll work on as we get the governor's budget and the February forecast numbers. I'll keep adding on to this, and I think I'll keep sharing this with you. And it just gives more, it's the same information on the general fund, and it's just more information on the activity level. So if you're interested in, you know, exactly how much is appropriate for Head Start and you want to get to that level of detail, you can see that here. And so I only have on this spreadsheet for you 2006 and 7, that biennium, and then 2008 and 9 as well. But like I said, I'll give you more detail in the future. That'll include the governor's budget and then details for 2010 and 11 as well. So with that, does anyone have any questions for me?
Thank you. Also, the departments will get into this, and one of the reasons I wanted to have this today is Ms. Adrians has been presenting this, or did present it to the Finance Committee, this exact handout, so I wanted you all to see what the Finance Committee is getting presented with. We're going over all of the budget areas. This page, you will get to know very, very well by the end of session, because that's this along with, it'll say Governor, House, Senate on it, and look a little different than this. But I'm kind of disappointed Representative Winkler wasn't here, because he's the one that was kind of, interested in the numbers, so we'll have to maybe, if you can talk with him separately, and let him start to get used to this. Any quick questions for our fiscal analyst? Okay. Good. Well, thank you, and we will see you at committee every week and be in touch with you about the numbers. Next, we're going to have a presentation of the governor's budget by the Department of Education. And did I see Commissioner Sagrin here or not? I don't think I saw her. She was here at 8 o'clock this morning. Oh, Commissioner Sagrin's in traffic.
We're going to do the
Okay, so my understanding is the commissioner's in traffic. If you don't all know, the Department of Education is up in Roseville, and for another reason, 4 o'clock committee isn't the greatest. Probably as people might get stuck in traffic. It would be nice if it was a little bit earlier than this. We will have the testifier, and I am blanking out on your name. If you could say your name for the tape. Okay, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Michelle Weber, and I'm the Director of Program Accountability and Improvement at the Minnesota Department of Education. One of the initiatives that your committee also has jurisdiction over is the self-sufficiency programs, and we noticed right before the committee hearing started that there's a governor's initiative that would be of interest to you. And that is the Fatherhood Leadership Initiative. That's on page 297 from the Department of Finance budget pages.
We have tabs. It's under the Lifelong Learning tab, page 297. Thank you to the staff for getting the books ready. They're in great shape.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. The Fatherhood Leadership Initiative is a governor's proposal that is for $500,000 each year of the biennium. And what this would be, the funds are from federal TANF funds, and this would be for grant programs to local community-based organizations to strengthen the relationships of fathers with their children, as well as enhance responsible parenting. The initiative will also provide a certification program through higher education and technical assistance to programs that are serving fathers. The initiative is a partnership between the Governor's Council on Faith and Community Services, the Minnesota Department of Education, and local programs that are serving fathers. Rather than focusing on father absence, this will focus on father involvement. So the grant programs will be to local agencies that encourage and support fathers in involvement with their children. Very general overview. If you have any questions, I'll do my best to answer them for you, but Lee Buckley from the governor's office really would be the most appropriate person to respond to questions, but we can certainly provide written responses, get any follow-up for you.
Just in time, Commissioner. Well, give me time to get the coat off. Any questions about, I have not seen this before, so I think obviously we'll become more familiar with this. Representative Murphy?
Madam Chair and Ms. Weber, can you tell me if this is a new program and if it's modeled after anything else in the country, please?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, this program is not necessarily new. We did submit a federal application to the U.S. Department of Education, I believe it was, to fund a similar initiative last year, and we were not successful. But in the past, there have been male responsibility grants that have engaged in some of the similar initiatives. Since those grants, the existence of those grants, there's been more research on effective practices. So this would support new research. So it would be new initiatives focused on that research that shows effective practices for father involvement.
Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Weber. Will there be or is there an effort for evaluation tied to this plan?
Yes, there is. A very, very intense evaluation, yes.
Is there another question? Okay, with that, why don't we bring up the commissioner? Thank you. and we'll start to go through the rest of the Department of Education's budget. We need just a minute here. It was tempting to ask about the male responsibility grants, but we'll have to talk about that another time and what those are. Welcome to the committee.
Hi.
If you could state your name for the record.
Thank you. I'm Commissioner Alice Segrin. And I apologize for being late. I was all the way in Eden Prairie, caught in rush hour traffic. So.
Well, thank you for making it. I know you were here at 8 o'clock this morning as well. So.
Thank you. Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk to you all about the Governor's Initiative in Early Childhood Education. And I also do want to also recognize Representative Slawick and the work that she's been doing for the last probably 4 years on this issue. She really has been a leader in the area, as well as a number of other folks that are on this committee and others that probably will be joining her in the future on the issue. The first thing that we want to talk about is probably the centerpiece of the Governor's initiative this year, and that is the Governor's scholarships for at-risk students. And the focus of that is to really look at preparing students or children, they're not students yet, but children, four-year-olds, for kindergarten. And we know that there's a lot of research out there that says that when you do this, investment in the academic impact is very strong. We also know that with the analysis that we have done and studies that we've done about kindergarten readiness, we know that between 11 and 12% of our students are not ready, have no skill set at all in the area of literacy or math. The other children are in process. They have, and I want to caution, and I feel very strongly about this, and I think there are educators here around the table, too, that would probably agree that we don't want to, because of some assessment at 3 years of age or something at 4 years of age, all of a sudden label a child as not going to be ready forever and ever, or that, you know, this is an indicator that they're really going to be at risk of failure. Children are so different between, you know, birth through third grade. In fact, there's really been sort of a rule of thumb that we really don't want to even start testing kids till about third grade, because developmentally they all change and learn at different rates. And not until about third grade can you really kind of have a more of a consistent ability to assess. And so because of that, we want to do as much as we can to look at the skill sets that they should be having that prepare them for literacy and the counting skills, et cetera, that they need. But we also want to, make sure that we're not also just saying, oh, if you're not ready by this age, that's it for you. You know, you're condemned for the rest of your life. So that, you know, I think we need to, really think about that also. But the Governor's Scholarship would be focused on those not ready, not yet ready, about the 12%. That's about 7,000 to 8,000 students that it would be focused on. And the scholarships would be available for those students that qualify for free and reduced lunch. And I think that's 180% of poverty.
Just Commissioner, are you on page 260? Is that what that be?
You know, I am not on any page. I am just kind of talking off the cuff right now.
You're on your own page.
With some notes.
Well, we're on the early childhood tab members, the first item. So if they may try to follow along, but we're
you're not
going to
follow along with me. I'm jumping all over the page. And the cost for the first year, and this would be the ramp-up year, would be about $392,000. Not about, but it is $392,000. And then the base funding for the next year would be $28.5 million. And that, again, as I said, would serve about 7,000 students. The next area that we're really looking at are three additional proposals that would enhance existing programs and reinforce what these programs are already doing and help them even be better. We would really like to, in many, many of our early childhood programs, we have people working with children, but they don't necessarily have a lot of educational background on, you know, maybe knowing, some intuitively might know what children need as far as some reading and literacy skills, but what we're proposing to do is to provide some training for people that are working with our children. And it would be in three areas. observing child behavior, assessing children's progress, and communicating this to parents, and planning curriculum activities and instruction based on child assessment. So giving people that are working with children every day who maybe don't have a license in early childhood at least have some training around these areas. The early childhood offerings are a combination of public and private programs with varying staff qualification requirements that usually that the children are going to right now. And as I said, license is not required for teachers in Head Start and some of our school readiness programs, or for caregivers and teachers in child care programs. The only teacher licensure that is required right now is in the early childhood family education programs. So this program would be targeted and through the development of foundational and sequential training modules to early childhood programs and will infuse rigor into current training offerings that already do exist for our interested members.
Commissioner, I just have to ask, or I could ask Ms. Carlson, is that page 263, the teacher training? Okay. We like to try to follow around if we can.
I'm sorry.
No, thank you. All of our committees are going through this today and through the next several days. So.
And before I do the next one, I'm going to lean over and ask her on which page I'll be
thank
on the
you.
Same page with all of you. The training will be ongoing, and the appropriation the first year, of course, would be $154,500, and then the cost year for the second year would be approximately $70,000. And there would be worldwide web delivery and on-site delivery also. The next one being the Early Childhood Family Education Accountability, and that's page 262.
Thank you.
And the Early Childhood Family Education Statute has been around for a long time, but we haven't really paid a lot of attention to it in the last few years. Meanwhile, Head Start and school readiness statutes have been updated to include some accountability provisions. And so we looked at ECFE and said, is it time for us to kind of look at some evaluation and results in those areas? And so we are proposing that a submission of a plan and application process prior to approval for ECFE be something that would be important. And this proposal would bring ECFE in line with our Head Start and our school readiness requirements that we have now. Also, we would like to bring the ECFE program components into sharper focus on parent education and the promotion of sound child developmental practices. And then we also would like to add a component that would actually encourage ECFE programs to focus on better participation by the families that are representative of the community. And I'll just be very blunt with you. I think a lot of ECFE programs have been very attractive to more high-income or middle-income families. And many times some of our other families, low-income families, have not felt as comfortable coming to ECFE programs. And so we want to make sure that all demographic populations have the same comfort and welcome and access. And that has not been the fault of the ECFE programs. I want to make that certainly clear. But as we're thinking about how to reach out to families, we probably need to be, stepping back a little bit and thinking about that and how we can make those programs more accessible, if you will, to all families. Then we're also proposing that beginning in fiscal year 2011, the district may not certify an ECFE level unless it has been approved. It has approved ECFE levy. I'm sorry. that didn't make any sense. Levy. Unless it is an approved plan on file. So we want to make sure that there is an approved plan that is demonstrating the components that we would like to see as far as accountability and results. The cost. The other programs that we have in community education have a 10% limit on equipment expenditures, and so we would apply that same 10% limit to ECFE programs too. The cost for year one is $211,000, and the cost for year two is $196,000. And then the school readiness area, which is page 264.
Mm-hmm.
This is a proposal to improve the educational offerings in Head Start and school readiness programs and to embed an educational component in child care center programs in order to positively impact the achievement gap. We had a summit on school readiness back in the summer, and I think you all have had that report already. And there were 10 program elements, just to reiterate, that this summit identified as things that we should consider as we're looking at programs such as Head Start or child care programs, etc. And the governor and our department has identified three of those elements to be addressed by this proposal. Number one would be compensatory services, instruction that accelerates literacy and language development and mathematical thinking. Number two, the instructional content and activities that are of sufficient length and intensity. And number three, highly trained professionals. And currently, as we know, and we kind of iterated before, that even in the area of training in the areas of literacy and mathematical thinking skills, there isn't a lot of that educational training we, you know, proposed before in previous discussion here to do that. We also want to have school districts apply for funds to send licensed early childhood education teachers into Head Start and school readiness in child care programs to provide the focused content. We think that this would be a cost-effective way of using our highly trained licensed teachers to come in and do that without necessarily having to hire whole new groups of staff. And it would be during a scheduled block of time, at least 3 hours per day for 4 days per week. And these teachers would also serve as on-site mentors and coaches to the existing program staff. So we think that it would be an exciting concept and opportunity to work together. We also know that we've had 3 years of Minnesota Department of Education kindergarten readiness studies, and we know that those demonstrate a need for improvement in the school readiness of young children in order to narrow the achievement gap. And this is particularly acute in two developmental areas, again, language literacy and mathematical thinking. Those seem to be the areas where kids are not yet ready, so we want to focus on that. So we will be really heavily focused on, and that, as I said. And this proposal also will help develop more integrated early childhood settings, as recommended by Dr. Reynolds during last week's hearing. The other thing that I wanted to mention, too, and Representative Slavik, I don't know if you've talked to the committee about this, but you had been or have heard about some of Oklahoma's strategies and what they're doing, too, and this kind of ties in with some of their things that they're doing. The cost of the School Readiness Improvement Program would be $4.1 million a year. And that kind of gives just a kind of a brief overview of the highlights of the governor's proposal, and we would be certainly happy to answer any questions, and our staff certainly stands ready to give you details.
Well, thank you. I hope the members understand that for programs that stayed the same, they're not in the governor's overview. So what we're talking about today are changes and his proposals for change. I hope members have some questions because I think these are interesting proposals and all, you know, things that could move young children ahead. I just want to, I'll kick it off with one question, then we'll start a list here. The one on page 264, the last one you talked about, I didn't quite, so you would have teachers come in from schools to work with Head Start and child care programs. Would that be, I just think, well, aren't they going to be teaching in their other programs, or how does that work?
Chair Slaver, this is the Oklahoma model that you heard about in Denver, where the school district contracts the early childhood licensed teachers and sends them out. So essentially, where they're sent out is their classroom. Okay. So they're not. We have quite a few districts who their early childhood teachers are employed less than full time because they're teaching, you know, a couple hours in ECFE or 3-4 hours in school readiness. And so some of the person power, the teacher power, if you will, is already employed in the districts, and this would could be additional time for them, or they could be hired on an hourly basis to do this. But Oklahoma's found that it's been really successful. It has a really direct impact on the children, and that's what we're trying to get at here, to mirror the elements that we heard about at the summit. So it's a way kind of to get it out there fast to the kids. Not that, I mean, we have a training proposal too, so we don't want to ignore the teachers that are out there that are with the children, but it's another strategy, if you will, to get to help for the at-risk kids.
Thank you. Well, maybe as a follow-up, if you could get us a one-pager on the Oklahoma program and how it works, because I can't remember exactly how it works, but just to give us a... it's always good to use models, and don't always have to reinvent the wheel, but just so maybe we can understand a little better of how it works.
We certainly can do that, Madam Chair. I've never borrowed anything from Oklahoma before, so it's kind of interesting in talking to them. But they're quite a ways ahead of us in early childhood activity.
That's what I hear. So we want to catch up with Oklahoma, don't we? Right?
I think so.
Yes. Okay. Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've heard in the last couple of meetings, we've heard some different numbers, and they're conflicting, and I'm just curious if we can get some clarification as to why they would conflict. I think I asked Professor Reynolds when he was here about the readiness issue and how we determine who's ready for kindergarten and who's not, and asked him for some kind of a number as to what currently how many kids are not ready for kindergarten, and the number that was thrown out here was 40-50%. And I see in here we're talking about 12%. Can you just speak to that discrepancy a little bit and tell me what that means?
Commissioner Seagren.
Madam Chair and Representative Eastland. Yes, we've had quite a lot of discussion about that. The report that the Department of Education and that a lot of organizations have used throw around the 40-50%, and that report, and Karen, you can help me, or Carlson, can help me with the levels of proficiency that are in that report, and one is not yet ready. I mean, they don't have any skills indicated that would say that they have any idea about any of the basic phonetics, etc. Then you have another level that's in process. And in that level, which is, and the not yet is about 12%. The in process is about another 30%, 35%. And when they're in process, they could have 2 of 4 indicators, 3 of 4 indicators, 1 of 5 indicators in math and literacy skills. They're in process. And remember, when they're 3 and 4 years old, and I've got little grandkids, and each one, I've got 3, and they each have been developed differently. It's fascinating to watch them. One will speak more quickly than the next one, and one will be much more physically aggressive and jumping all over the couch, and the other one will be more timid and not as physically active. So that in-process category is one that they combined with the not-yet-ready. And say that, you know, 50% of our kids are not ready for kindergarten. But they are in some process, and those kids will be fine. We feel that developmentally they'll catch up, and there might be 1 or 2 things, and you want to pay attention to that. But you really want to pay attention to those, that 12% that truly, totally are not ready. And if you think about it logically, if we had 50% of our students that were not ready in kindergarten in the state of Minnesota, we would really be panicked. But when you really think about it, most of our children, the large percentage of our children in Minnesota, are ready for kindergarten. 80% of our kids have no problem with kindergarten and going on to first grade. In first grade, the majority of our kids in the state of Minnesota are doing just fine in first grade. But we have 10 to 15% that are not, and that's where our achievement gap is. And so logically, you know, if that carried through, we would be in a world of hurt, and we are not. But we do have a large achievement gap, and it is coming from that 10 to 12% that have not been intervened with in an effective way early enough to get them ready then for kindergarten and then to be successful in kindergarten and go on. And I also want to reiterate, too, nothing that we do, not one program, is a silver bullet. We should be putting some focus in early childhood, absolutely. We should be looking at kindergarten issues. We should be looking at elementary, middle school, high school. It's a whole system, and we have kids, and when we have kids that are at risk, because we get them through an early childhood program or a kindergarten program or get them reading in third grade doesn't mean that they're not going to fall off in the future if we don't continue to support them all the way through the system. And that's where I think we have kind of made a mistake over the years. We have said Head Start was going to be the answer if we just had this comprehensive program, and we know that after third grade, the achievement level levels out and then starts to decline, the effect of Head Start. Why? I think it's because we have thought that that was going to be enough. And it isn't when you have complex children with lots of risk factors. We've got to really be intensive and intentional all through those children's lives. So that's a long answer to your question.
Representative Eastland, follow-up. I just want to let the committee know, too, we are going to have the department talk about the school readiness assessment and what's actually in there a week from today. And we also are going to have the Department of Human Services talk about their assessment. So we are going to do kind of an assessment day as well. But I have a feeling this is, you know, it's a little bit debatable. I mean, there's a little bit of wiggle room on these statistics. Representative Eastland?
Maybe I should wait with my next question because another comment that the commissioner made was that there really isn't a reliable or a meaningful way to test kids until they're in third grade. Am I saying what you said, or am I saying something that you didn't intend to say? That's kind of what I heard. You said testing isn't meaningful until the third grade, is kind of what you said.
Mr. Stevens?
Yeah, I'm sure what I'm saying is that, you know, a paper pencil test, fill in the dots that we're familiar with, that kind of assessment, you know, really, you know, the testing and assessment people and just educators have, you know, said that that's probably not. Their kids are not ready for that kind of a test. Are there assessments and observations and ways to look at early phonetic competencies and early math skills? Yes, there are assessments, if you want to call them that, and ways of looking at that. So, you know, you can test whether a child can say the sound of each of the letters in the alphabet. You can see how you can see if they can do have those rhyming skills. There are a lot of fundamental things to reading that have to happen before they can really put their little words and stuff together. And so part of that is that. The same with mathematics, the counting skills and getting that concept of a unit and what is a unit and then building on those mathematical skills. Those are things that you can teach and we do almost naturally as parents all the time and as teachers. And you can do that and you can observe that and there are benchmarks or not, I don't know if benchmarks is the word, but skill sets that you can make sure that they have as they're going into kindergarten. And so you can do that kind of assessment.
Okay. I think, Madam Chair, I think that's interesting because I think that's kind of one of the issues that's kind of foundational to this whole thing we're talking about here is how do we know that we are really accurately characterizing what where different children are and what their learning abilities are and what we can actually influence. And I think it'll be interesting to have that presentation and talk a little bit about our kindergarten assessment stuff because I think that's something that is going to be really foundational to everything that we do.
And Madam Chair, and I just want to reiterate again, these are assessments to, you know, help us as educators you know, find, you know, maybe an area where a child is hasn't quite got it to help build those foundational skills. But again, kids are so different at those early ages. Some learn faster, some learn slower, some just want to not learn anything for a while and just, you know, climb on chairs and have a good time. But that doesn't mean they're not learning either. That's the caution that you have to have. You don't want to condemn a child because, oops, he has met that checklist and there's one there and that's going to be the end of his life. So.
And Madam Chair, Commissioner, what's wrong with climbing around on chairs and having fun?
It is. Great. I think it's great fun. I do that quite a bit with my grandkids. So.
Maybe you do that on the second floor, but you know, now that we're on the fourth floor.
I'm sorry.
Excuse me.
Just one more.
Representative Eastland.
One more quick follow-up. Or I'll get up on my chair here. Is there any way, Commissioner, that we could understand in our current environment? We have an assessment tool, and we kind of make an attempt to assess kindergarten readiness. Is there any way that we can find out if that works by looking at third graders and finding out what percentage of those kids kind of met our expectation as being low achievers and which ones were able to develop through the system and maybe caught up and maybe are doing just fine? Is there any way that we, and of the ones that we assessed as being kindergarten ready, how many of those dropped into the problem learner category? Is there any way we could kind of see that and evaluate that?
You know, we do have a couple more questions. We are going to have a whole committee hearing on this, and we also are going to, you'll see in the next presentation, Human Services, they are going to use another assessment tool. So we're actually going to have a whole other one to talk about here that goes younger even. Commissioner, we have two more. We have Representative Peterson, Representative Bly, and Representative Kranz.
I was just consulting with Ms. Carlson, and she said that, remember, we have standards for first, second, kindergarten, first and second grade. We don't have specific benchmarks, you know, because the benchmarks are what we test. So, you know, to talk about some kind of an alignment and predictor, it would probably be kind of difficult to do. And we don't, you know, I think we've made the good decision not to start testing those little kids, give them a little time to develop and have some time to grow over time.
Thank you. Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to get my thoughts around the scholarships and the amount of the scholarships. In our other committees, we've discussed with MILF and with other agencies, we've talked about the amount that it costs to provide a good early childhood program. And I also have a granddaughter, and we looked at a private program that cost $18,000 a year for a full-day program. And I know when the YMCA was here, they talked about their good, effective programs for $14,000 a year, and many daycare programs for a whole day are $12,000 a year. And that means that they've got good teaching staff and they've got a good curriculum and they really have the kind of developmental program that you'd want your child to be in. And I'm wondering about the $4,000 scholarships. Has there been thought, are there different funding streams that will be going into providing those monies that would need it to be a good program? Or do you have thoughts about how they'd be used? Are they half-day programs? Are they combined with other kinds of programs? I'm not sure how far $4,000 will go. So could you talk a bit more about that, please?
Sure.
Well, thank you. And I want to admit right up front that this has not been my big area of focus over my tenure at the legislature. It has been the K-12 area. I was just also, again, asking Ms. Carlson about the 4,000. And I clearly know that most of the full-day, everyday kinds of daycare are around 12,000 at least. This is not intended to pay for that full amount. And there would be certainly, if there's opportunity, I just asked Ms. Carlson if you were participating in the TANF program, eligible for that, or if you were eligible for basic sliding scale, but this is for those 180% of poverty. So they may be getting fully supported, and then this is sort of that gap group that that needs some help and support, and we're trying to look at that group. It wouldn't completely support the program, but hopefully that would give them some more support than what they have now, which they don't have any right now.
Representative Peterson?
Well, just to follow up with one, thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up with one other question, who would the department then be the fiscal agent and would provide the oversight for how those funds would be used?
Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, yes. The first step would be to approve programs according to the criteria, and then we develop a list of approved programs that parents could then buy so that we have some standards of, not a capital S standard, some measures of quality in those programs. And then the way it would work is we would give the family a certificate, which would be essentially their scholarship, and they would bring it to the program, and the program would then get reimbursed up to the $4,000 from us.
Thank you.
Representative Blyne?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Segrin. I'm as I hear how this plan might work, I'm thinking that it kind of solves half of the problem, looking at at the research that talks about what really makes impact on improving the outcomes for at-risk kids. And the academic or the intellectual is one side, but the social relationship, perhaps dealing with childhood trauma, is another side. And I guess I'm wondering, one, is there a way to kind of develop expertise or understanding and ways of working with children on those issues? Because I think it's really foundational to their ability to do that intellectual development. And the other part would be maybe in reverse of the suggestion that we have early childhood licensed teachers come in and deal with academics in these programs, perhaps as early childhood practitioners develop the skills to work with these kinds of children, we move into the schools to help teachers learn a little bit more about how to deal with children who have serious emotional or social deficits.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, well, I think that the whole area of mental health could be another, you know, two or three meetings. And I know if Representative Greiling was here, her ears would be perked up a lot. I think how to deliver mental health services to students is another discussion. I think in our special ed area, I think we do have some highly qualified people that can work with special needs kids. It doesn't necessarily mean, though, that every child, you know, is categorized as a child in need of special education services. They may have some mental health issues, but, you know, doesn't get into that depth. As far as the social-emotional development of children, certainly that's important. And when we did the analysis of the, how kids were assessed in all the different categories that were assessed, if you will, or observed, we didn't find of the sample that we had that was a big glaring problem for the majority of students. Now, certainly you're going to have kids that, you know, might exhibit some emotional problems or temper tantrums or whatever, and it's hard at that time to really, you know, say that is, you know, a significant or serious problem. It, you know, could just be that they're going through a phase of, you know, some opposition. So, I don't know, Ms. Carlson, you may want to talk about some of the work that our department does and how those areas are assessed.
Madam Chair and Representative White, it's kind of hard because you haven't heard the spiel on the assessment yet, but to go back to that assessment, it does look at other developmental areas besides language and literacy and mathematical thinking. It looks at creativity, social development, physical development, and what we found consistently over the 3 years that we've done it is there's just a couple, maybe 2% of the children that are scoring not yet in any of the indicators in those areas. That's where the kids are the strongest. So we're doing something as parents and as early childhood professionals to have those kids in that greatest shape in those areas. So the mathematical and the literacy, and if you think about it, if you've gone into nursery schools and preschools and child care centers, and you know your own grandchildren or whatever children, those are, you know, kind of tougher. We don't usually work with children over, you know, how to think mathematically at a pre-operational stage. But we do certainly tend to their physical development. We're really big on their social development. I mean, and we talk to children about, you know, say thank you and sit still and all that kind of stuff that we do as parents. And so the kids are in our representative sample across the state are showing mostly good scores in those areas as compared to the intellectual development. So,
Representative Blyne, follow up.
Thank you. I guess my question goes to those most troubled, at-risk kids. And those are the ones I'm hearing that we want to try to help to move in the achievement gap. So I am concerned about the attention that we may pay to that and making sure that we have care providers that can deliver that or that can do that, and also understand how to help teachers deal with that. Because I don't think it necessarily always shows up as a special ed problem or a behavior problem. So, but it does impact learning.
We have Representative Kranz and Representative Ward, and then we want to squeeze in the Department of Human Services before we go here. So I'm hoping in the next 5 or 7 minutes or so, Representative Kranz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the Commissioner, I'm trying to digest all this information as fast as it's coming. And one of the areas of interest of mine is, being that I'm in a north suburban area, I think a lot of my two-income families use a family, friend, and neighbor type of idea. And so I'm curious and very interested in a lot of the training that we speak of to try to get these kids ready. Could you direct me to, like, the programs or maybe even the budget contributions to areas that would facilitate working with daycares and bringing them curriculum and training to get those kids up to speed too? I think a lot of the focus seems to lead around centers and things like that, but I think a majority of people in my neighborhood use the person next door. And I'm curious, I think there's a lot of need out there, and I think if we could fulfill that. So I guess if you could just direct me to the programs or the funding sources that would address those needs.
Representative Kranz, I think that, our committee is split into two, and so there's Department of Education and the Department of Human Services. I think I would fall more for the Department of Human Services. So you will be the first question. They're coming up next.
All right, thank you.
Yeah. So we're going to, I skipped Representative Murphy, so I'm sorry about that. We'll go to Representative Ward, Representative Murphy, and then the department.
Yes, Madam Chair. And my question may also be with the Department of Human Health Services, because my question is based on 0 to 3 year olds.
Is it regarding child care or?
It's regarding brain development that Representative Lane keeps talking about, and it's so important. I see where at four years old we're gonna offer some potential scholarships and, you know, pre-K and then, you know, ready for K and then kindergarten all day every day, and all those are so very important. But the most rapid growth of the brain is from 0 to 3, and that's my question, I guess, real quick.
Well, Commissioner, would you like to
I don't know if that's
respond to that. I think the question might be, what are we doing? I know that Representative Ward said he's going to go home this weekend and talk to his constituents about what he's working on here at the Capitol. So, do your proposals reflect things for 0 to 3 or brain development, or have you been thinking about that, or is that, what are your thoughts on that?
Madam Chair, I certainly agree, and I think that there's the research is out there that those early years are very, very important. And we have to start somewhere. it's what is the government's obligation to intervene with families and bring in children. A lot of children are in daycare at early ages too, babies, and I think we'll certainly, as time goes by, all of those things will be implemented. You just have to start somewhere. And that's really basically my answer.
Thank you. Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I think I heard you say that the $4,000 scholarship would be targeted for those at 180% of poverty or below, but also at those or for those who are not already in an MFIP program. Is that right? If they're in MFIP child care. So in follow-up to that, for those families that either come out of MFIP or are sanctioned out of MFIP, and so they're not in that child care, would they be eligible for this?
Ms. Carlson?
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, as long as they had income levels of 180% or lower, and this scholarship would be available for 1 year, it's the year preceding kindergarten. If the initial application, they need that income, but we're not going to, they can have different eligibility after that and still stay in the program, but yes, they would have to meet that income.
Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. For the families in MFIP, would the standards little s that we're talking about for the programs that the students seeking with scholarships are enrolled in, would those same standards apply to the MFIP child care?
Ms. Carlson?
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, you're like leading right into the next initiative, so why don't you hold that for the Department of Human Services.
Thank you, Ms. Carlson. And then just one follow-up,
Madam Chair. Murphy.
How would the department choose the students eligible for the scholarship if there are more students than scholarship funding?
Ms. Carlson?
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, first come, first serve.
Thank you. Thank you both for being here. And Commissioner Seagram's been very good about communicating. I've met with her a couple of times. If you're interested, we can do some follow-up work. We know you have a big job ahead of you, so we appreciate you being here. Next, we'll hear from the Department of Human Services. I think Chuck Johnson, who's the Assistant Commissioner of Children and Family Services, is going to talk to us first. There's only, I think, three proposals, so this hopefully I think we can end right on time and get in a couple of questions. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thank you. I am Chuck Johns with the Department of Human Services. Page that I'll be talking from is on page 58. I was told that was to be the same page number you'd see. I don't know if that's possible or not, but
let's see what tab that is. Thank you. It would be under the MFIP tab, page 58.
That's correct.
Okay. Let's see. Yes, we have that. So if you'd like to proceed, thank you.
Okay, Madam Chair, members, this is the recommendation from the governor is related to the Child Care Assistance Program. The governor recommends creating financial incentives for children, for child care assistance program providers to improve the school readiness of young children. When Ms. Katilnik was here, I believe last week, she described to you how the Child Care Assistance Program works now. And we will pay for eligible parents. They choose a provider, and we will pay a rate up to the maximum rate in law, which for child care centers right now covers about 54% of centers in the state, and for family child licensed child care covers about 65%. So our rates do not cover all the providers at all the rates that are charged around the state. What we're trying to do with this proposal is really to focus on a small number of at-risk kids to start by working with providers who are willing to enter into agreements with us under which the provider will agree to provide care with certain quality standards, focusing on health and safety, the ratios of child to adult, nurturing environment, staff turnover, the communication that goes on with families, and other things that we may look at as well as we're pulling this together. We would also look at measuring child's progress using the same tool that's used for the school readiness assessment for kindergartners. We're not talking about using a different tool, but using the same tool, which will be part of this project as well. What we would do essentially is enter into agreements with these providers, and we focus on providers who have a concentration of child care assistance program families. So we're trying to get at those areas where there are concentrations of lower income children being served by a particular program. Because about half the families who are in the CCAP program are MFIP or transition year families, we're talking about some of the most at-risk kids, lowest income, mostly single-parent families, and basic sliding fees, somewhat higher income, but again, very low-income families. The service agreements from the provider side would do two things. First, we would pay up to 25% above the rate that is currently set in law, the maximum rate for the type of provider that we're looking at, either the center or the family child care. So we would pay up that additional amount in order to buy slots that would provide these quality services. In addition, we would authorize care for full-time weekly care for a year for every child, and we would provide some stability that doesn't exist right now for some families in CCAP. What happens now, particularly it happens to unfit families, is the families participating, say, in job search or something, they have their child in child care, they get a job, things are going fine, then they lose their job. And then their kid comes out of child care. They get back into job search, but not as many hours, so they're having the kid now staying with grandma for a few months. And then they go back to work, but that other provider they used to go to is full now, so they're into another provider. And over that course of time, the child has a very unstable experience. And we're trying to deal, to the extent we can, with that issue as well. Because for these kids who often don't have very stable home lives, the stability of the care they're being provided can be a very important piece of it. So what we'd allow is to allow the child to stay in full-time care, even if the level of authorization that we would normally use would be changing based on the level of activity that the parent is involved in. This is really a way for us to start to move toward more of a pay-for-performance way of running the child care assistance program as well, looking toward not just providing a base rate of payment that covers the support for people while they're working and provides for a basic level of care consistent with our licensing standards, but also where appropriate to pay somewhat more in order to get some quality services to be targeted toward at-risk children. The program would serve 600 children. These would be children who are currently eligible under the basic sliding fee or NFIT transition year programs, and we'd serve children ages 0 to 5. We are also requesting as part of this one full-time equivalent position to work with on the evaluation of the project, because we do want to understand whether or not we're being effective in increasing the school readiness of these children and whether or not this service is actually working to provide more stable and quality care to the kids who we're targeting. Madam Chair, there are two additional proposals. Do you want me to do them all three at once?
Yes, I think that would be good, and then we will take questions.
Madam Chair, members, the other two proposals are really more along lines of fixes to the child care program. The first is to address an issue around retroactive eligibility. Right now, there is no limit to how far back we go to determine eligibility retroactively for some cases within the CCAP program. What that means in some situations is we can be going back as much as a year looking at past eligibility and making payments going back, which is a significant burden administratively, but also is a program integrity issue in terms of recreating things that have happened quite a while ago. We're proposing to put in place a six-month limit on how far back we'll go in terms of looking at retroactive eligibility for people who are applying for child care assistance. That's consistent with the number of months that's used in MFIP to determine how long you have to be in MFIP in order to be eligible to get TY when you leave, so that's sort of what we tied it to. And there is a small savings that's associated with that change. The second change is really addressing a unintended consequence that was created in the MFIP transition year program in 2003 when we changed the eligibility for the basic sliding fee program. In 2003, we changed the eligibility to basic sliding fee to have two separate eligibility, an entrance eligibility of 175% of poverty and then an exit eligibility of 250%. So basically, you had to be below 175 at initial eligibility, but then you could stay in until your income went over 250. That also applies to families coming off of transition year. But what happens is really a differential way that families are being treated coming off of MFIP and into the transition year. For a family who's been receiving child care while they're on MFIP, when they're doing their job search or in school or whatever, and then get a job and go on to transition year, their eligibility for transition year is considered against the 250 level because they've already been on child care assistance. They're considered already in. Some families exit MFIP without having ever used child care while they were on MFIP, but now need it for the transition year once they've left the program because now they're working. Maybe they just patched something together with friends and family while they were on, but they want to put their kid into a program now that they're working full time. the way that the law is structured, essentially they are subject to the 175 eligibility test because they haven't been on CPAP before. That doesn't make a lot of sense from the perspective of people coming off of them. The intent of the transition year policy is really to support families for that transition year after they left the program. This addresses that equity issue, and there's a small cost in the governor's proposal to cover that.
Is that, Assistant Commissioner, is that everything then for your changes?
That's everything for the changes here.
Okay, thank you. If we have questions, I know Representative Kranz, I do want to make a comment, and then also remember we left the last committee with Representative Wardlow asking what would be the one thing we could do. This kind of adds another layer, and the first time I've seen this is today. It's interesting. It's an interesting idea sort of to incent quality, right, as far as the first proposal, into child care, and an interesting way to do it. It is hard, again, for us to know how it all fits together and what would be the one thing to do. Why don't we do Representative Kranz, and then we could maybe ask the question at Representative Wardlow, or if you want to hear what they think the one or best thing of these would be to start, or if you don't want to follow up with that question at this point, you can decide.
Since I've already asked it, Madam Chair, they can answer it.
Okay. So we'll have the answer on that after. Let's take Representative Kranz first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did the testifier, did you share my question from the committee here? I mean, I'm looking for for assistance. I mean, you're asking me to re-ask my question in a sense. I'm looking for options for local daycares, you know. As a person who used daycare for both of my kids, I had the luxury of having my mother available for a part of that time. She did a wonderful job. I think that that's an ever-popular solution to daycare. But I'm curious, if she wanted to go and brush up on her skills, whether it's counting, adding, curricular areas, what might she do? What would I advise her to do? And I understand that the lower income is being addressed in a lot of ways. I'm looking for middle-class working families. What are their options?
Madam Chair and Representative Kranz, we do provide training to child care providers, and that does include family, friend, and neighbor providers. We actually changed the law, I think, a couple of years ago to open up that part of the technical assistance we do to include family, friend, and neighbor. It is actually the most popular, most used choice of how people provide child care for the children is through family, friends, and neighbors, not through our licensed settings. And so it's important that we support it. It's also important from our perspective to support it because it is where a lot of low-income children are as well, where we do have a special interest. We do have training resources that are available. I could ask Deb Swenson-Clatt to come down. She could give you more detail on how that works, actually, and how it will be accessed.
You could ask that. We're still in the phase of learning what kind of what's out there, and then when you layer on the new stuff, new information, it's hard for us to distinguish how it all fits together and what's there already.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't need to necessarily go over it right now. If we could just, I don't want to spend committee time on that right now, but if I could just get some documentation or provided to our group, we could digest it at our convenience. Thank you, though.
Okay. Are there other questions on this program? Any questions? Representative Wardlow?
I just gave a note about a child care provider who trains others with a phone number. I suggest calling her because she really knows her stuff, and she could probably direct you better than anybody.
Well,
Representative Kranz,
it might be worth having her come in and talk to us.
Committee networking.
That's why I gave her the note.
This is good. We are having what we're calling Citizen Day. We're having a couple things. We're having Advocate Day and then kind of Citizen Day, and it would be good to have her in. We particularly want people to come in that have been successful, that have either overcome barriers or know where to find the training. We're kind of looking to those models so we could get people that are frustrated also to help them. So we'll be scheduled. We are scheduling that. I know we have talked to several of you about bringing somebody from your district for that day, and if you're interested, please talk to us. We're trying to make sure we have a variety. Please talk to us. We're trying to make sure we have a variety of programs. Are there any other questions? Representative Murphy?
Madam Chair, it's more a comment than a question, I think. But I was looking through the basic sliding fee child care assistance, and I'm excited about the discussion that we're having about improving standards in child care across the board, in preparing readiness. But I also know that we went through a period of time when there was a shortage of basic sliding fee child care, and there's still a waiting list, and I just want to be mindful of the need for slots as we improve quality and not to choose one over the other. We have to be mindful of both, I think.
Well, and as we committee members get into building a budget, and we will also hear bills on all of these items, we have the opportunity to put the money where we want to. And so that's something we will want to keep in mind, is that there is a waiting list out there. And I'm not sure how much that will cost. We can always ask the department to run some figures on what it would cost to clean up the waiting list. So that may be something we might want to head towards, too. I would like to ask Sharika Tilnick to come down, because we just met about these three programs, and she said she was going to tell us how they all fit together and how the scholarships fit together. So if you could just comment on that as the last thing, or if anybody has a question, because I was kind of saying along Representative Ward those lines of, you know, here's it's more, and sometimes more is good, and sometimes... we have to be responsible representatives, and we don't want to make more, to pay for more, to create more government just for the sake of it. Obviously, we want to do it for the kids and for the children. How do you see this all fitting together, and can you talk a little bit about that?
Madam Chair, I'm paid to think about things like that, because I do have to be responsible for government money, and we did have a proposal on the table, so I keep trying to think how all this money would interrelate. And get more details about each of the proposals. Actually, I don't think any of these proposals overlap. I think they complement each other very nicely. The MELF proposal that you heard about last week is one that focuses on high concentrations of low-income families, but it's only in St. Paul, and it's in communities with high concentrations of low-income families. So it's a very specific thing with a very specific evaluation and a very limited amount of time that it's going to be happening. The school readiness service agreements that the Department of Human Services is talking about are similar to the MELF grants. However, they would be delivered through a different mechanism, through an infrastructure that already exists. It's not a new separate pot of money. It is adding on to something that we're already doing to support economic stability and seeing if with a little bit more money we can be strategic and also serve the kids too. That money would not be, that pilot would not, or that project would not be happening in St. Paul. The MELF project would be happening in St. Paul, and the project from the Department of Human Services would be geared toward trying to make it work in outstate Minnesota and in other parts of the metropolitan area. And as you know, in this project there's a very limited number of children that will be served and a limited number of providers, but we're trying to get as much distribution as possible as we go forward with this. Both of those projects focus on high concentrations of low-income families or communities with high concentrations of low-income families. The scholarship programs, as I have been told, are intended to build on existing resources. So we've still got 29,000 families in the child care assistance program that won't be part of our service agreements, that might be using child care somewhere else in the state, but might not be able to pay for the gaps in care because their authorized activities aren't correct, or they might not be able to pay for the difference between the maximum that we can pay in the assistance program and the rate that the provider charges. The scholarship would help these families a lot because it would allow them to go to a provider that they couldn't go to otherwise. And that provider might serve two CCAP kids, it might serve one CCAP kid, it doesn't have to be high concentrations. And so it offers opportunities for us to test a lot of different things at a lot of different levels of intensity and to get some really good information that we can use to tweak and shape as we go forward.
Ms. Katilnik, thank you. And you said, I remember as we were talking, you said it has to be at 25%. A provider has to agree to have 25% of their cases or children on participate in the program?
Madam Chair, the threshold that we're talking about for the Child Care Assistance Program School Readiness Service Assessments our service agreements, I guess, is 25%, recognizing that there are probably providers in rural Minnesota that do not serve 25% CCAP kids. And there are some family child care providers that don't serve 25% CCAP kids. There is a provision in there that allows for a waiver of 25% in order to be sure that we get geographic and provider type distribution.
Thank you. Although if it was a provider of four kids, that would mean one of the kids. So in a way, that could work either way. I suppose the bigger you are, it would be harder to get the 25%. So any questions from after that? I think for me it's interesting because it will help the rural areas. It will be statewide and offers us some alternatives to the scholarship program. Anything else?
Madam Chair, if I could just add to what
Ms. Commissioner
said. I think that another way to think about this, I'm not sure we want to put all of our eggs into one basket in the way that we're approaching this. Trying to target low-income kids when we don't have sort of a single system where they all just are is not an easy thing to do. And having multiple approaches to go at it is one way to ensure that we have a better way of trying to get into different communities and get different kids into a higher quality program. Building off of the CCAP infrastructure is one strategy, but also having a more sort of privatized and open way of doing it with the scholarship piece. I think gives us multiple ways of getting at families who are not always easy to connect with, and where we can't just expect that they're going to walk up to the door and be there. To get the benefit when it's there, where we have to spend a little bit more time figuring out how we target it. So I would say not put all our eggs in one basket, but don't spend a dollar unless it's on a low-income or at-risk kid. I think those are the ways I'd probably get at Representative Birdlaw's question.
Okay, thank you. And I think that is helpful because I think we sort of see it as more and more and hard to know what's happening and to know they're complementary. And I think, I don't know about all of you, it's going to take us a while to get used to what the different ideas are and to sort them out and work through them. Thank you for being here. And
Madam Chair, did you want me to address the TANF refinancing page as well?
Well, you know, we have 7 minutes, and actually I would. It is complicated, but members, we talked about this ahead of time, and I think the members need to know about this, and I think we'll spend more time on this at another hearing, but yes, I would like the members to be aware of this.
Madam Chair, it can't get too complicated because I don't know that much about it, so I'll give you an overview of what it is.
Tell us briefly, on the TANF refinancing page 232.
On page 232, this is Governor's recommendation around use of TANF funds that would refinance $72 million this biennium and $21 million in the next biennium of TANF. TANF is the Federal Resource Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, the Welfare Block Grant. We are allowed to use those dollars for a number of purposes. One of those purposes is to transfer it to the Child Care Development Fund and then use it for child care purposes. That's what this page is doing. It's transferring these dollars to the Child Care Development Fund. But because it's refinancing, it is then taking a like amount of dollars of general fund out of the child care programs and using those dollars then elsewhere in the governor's budget. So it isn't changing anything about the child care assistance programs in terms of how much money is there, how many people we can serve, what kind of service they get, what the program looks like. But it's changing around the funding, putting more TANF in child care and putting more general fund elsewhere in the budget.
Over, Assistant Commissioner, and we can talk about this. If we didn't do the refinance and we didn't change the funds around, we would actually have that money to spend on child care. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct, although the governor wouldn't be funding a number of the other initiatives that he has in his budget. It's a matter of where the priority is.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to ask specifically that. This is an offset, federal dollars, then freeing up monies for other things. Where is the governor putting those other monies?
Madam Chair, Representative, they're in the governor's budget. They aren't dedicated any particular place. In terms of the amount that's there, is certainly well within what we're spending in the new spending, the governor's human services recommendations. But they aren't designated or targeted.
There are other questions. This is it's going to be an old controversy here at the legislature. We've been doing this how long now?
Madam Chair, I believe it first did it in 2000.
2000. So for 7 years, we've been taking TANF and redistributing it like this. And it's difficult, I think, that this committee needs to talk about if we want, you know, we could also not do this, but we'll see. I mean, it becomes more difficult. The Senate has their own ideas about what they want to do with this money, and the House will have their ideas, and the governor will have his ideas, and it will all come out in the end, but it's an interesting way of financing. Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up a bit, and also with the last speaker. Can you be more specific about the programs? I mean, you say you're redistributing, and this is new to me, so I'm really just curious about what other programs are specifically being funded.
Just a sample. You could pick any program that's in the governor's budget that's funded with general fund dollars and say that might have been this money. I mean, what it does is it takes the $70 million or so, makes it available for any general fund spending, and you're as familiar as I am with the proposals the governor's put forward. $70 million of that total that he's put forward is represented by the dollars that are here. I also want to add, I didn't say this when I started, we had $142 million TANF reserve on the bottom line after the forecast. So these are not dollars that are coming from existing TANF expenditures. This was a reserve that ended up after the forecast, and so we could spend it on other things. This is the use that's proposed here.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair? Oh, sorry.
Representative Graffel?
Was there anyone else in line? I'm sorry.
No, you're next.
Chair Slawick and I dealt with this last year in Jobs and Economic Opportunity, and maybe it's a little more in-depth discussion, but could you explain a little bit why there continues to be the surplus available? I remember 2 years ago we had a longer discussion about this in committee, and I guess, you know what, scratch it, there's 3 minutes left, forget it. Well, that'll be a topic for some other time, but not, if I recollect, that was a pretty lengthy conversation in our committee, actually explaining why there continues to be a reserve and a rollover of increasing funds, and maybe that'd be a nice white paper someday.
No, Representative Graffel, I think that would be a good idea to have that discussion, because we need to talk about how we're financing our programs here at the legislature. There's some things you hear about, $2 billion surpluses and TANF refinancing, and basically I think what we know is there's not a lot of new money anywhere. So what we do what the governor does is propose things like this. So, but what it allows him to do is make proposals, and so we get that. We will have the opportunity to make our own decisions. Next week we will have our objectives to go to child care center and see the MFIP and basic sliding fee, and we'll be talking about the assessments both at the kindergarten level and the preschool level on Thursday. With that, we are adjourned.